Members present at this time, Representative Sarah Hannon, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative Ivy Sponholz, Representative George Rauscher, Vice Chair Representative Greyer Hopkins, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Today, we are a little behind schedule, but hopefully we'll be able to still get through our business for the day. As we're getting started, if we could please ask folks to turn off their cell phones, we'd appreciate that. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Douglas Bridges. Thank you to both of you for your help. So today, what we realized, just to sort of put this in context earlier on, is some of these topics are coming up, but we haven't had some of the foundational meetings so that people have a little bit of a foundation to build on. So this week's committee hearings are set up so that we can get updates from different industries and understand the taxes that that industry pays to the state. So today we're going to be talking about mining industry taxes. We'll have a presentation from the Department of Revenue, and then we're going to get a mining industry update. So I think we will go ahead with the Department of Revenue. Are those folks? Here we go. All right. I was just looking at the notes here. So what we'll do is try to take questions at the end of each slide. And so it looks like this, we have Brandon Spanos here in the room, but also online we have Kelly Mazzei, and Marty Parsons. And so I don't know if either of those are to help you out with your presentation, but if you want them at some point, let me know.
Okay. They're lifelines.
Okay.
All right. For the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. And I'm going to give a brief overview, or basically a mining tax 101 for the Alaska mining tax. And thank you for the invitation to come before you today. So on the agenda is I'm going to briefly go over the history of the Alaska mining tax, which dates back to 1913. And we actually call it the mining license tax. That's how it's written in statute. I'll go over the depletion and expenses and exemptions and the tax specifics towards the end of the presentation. And we'll also go over the return calculation. So the tax began back in, as I mentioned, 1913. It was restructured several times over the years. And it originally had a 0.5% tax on mining net income of more than $5,000, and there was no tax for income, net income less than $5,000. Alaska levies a mining tax on mining net income and royalties received in connection with mining properties and activities in Alaska. The tax division collects mining license tax primarily on those engaging in coal and hard rock mining. And I'm on slide four. There were, as I mentioned, numerous changes to the tax between 1915 and 1953. In 1951, there was the territorial legislature authorized the 3 1/2 year exemption for all new mining operations, and that's still in statute today. And then in 1955, the current tax structure was adopted, which, as the slide four shows, there's no net income, or rather, there's no tax on that first tier of net income between $0 and $40,000, and then between $40,000 and $50,000, there's a 3% tax, and then it gets up to a 7% tax for over $100,000.
And just take a pause here for a second to see if anyone has any questions on this. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Spanos. The 3 1/2 year exemption, have you ever done any calculations as to how much money that entails? And is the goal to give an operation the opportunity to break even before we start taxing them, or?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I don't know that we've done a calculation on lost revenue. Most mines do operate at a net loss in the first year, so it generally would be minimal. I do have a slide further in the presentation that actually shows, actually this might be in the notes, but I will mention how many we've actually approved. The number is quite low on how many have actually been approved. I think we've only ever had something like, that's in my notes as well, further on it. In the double digits of those trying to claim the credit, and only something like 7 that we've ever approved.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thank you. It's a fairly simple structure compared to our tax rates. How do we compare to other states in our taxation of our mining?
Through the Vice Chair Hopkins, the tax structure is relatively unique. It is a tax based on net on income, so it's structured like an income tax. Most states have a tax on either weight or value of the product. It's a severance tax, a true severance tax, whereas this is a it is a severance tax, but it's based on the net income of the operation.
And I just want to remind myself, when you say the 3.5 year exemption, it's from the date, you know, whatever day one is, the day that the mine is considered operational, then it's the 3.5 years from that date.
Madam Chair, that's correct. So 3.5 years from the date that that the initial production, they don't pay tax for that 3.5 years.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Continuing on to slide 5. So the who needs to get a mining license tax? We're often asked that question. Anyone who's operating or extracting or attempting to extract valuable metals or ores or minerals, so basically anyone that's mining. The mining license tax, or rather the mining license, is in lieu of a business license, and so it's on any miner, even those that are doing just small suction dredging or placer mining. They also need to get a license with us, but as we saw on the previous slide, it's very unlikely that they would actually pay any tax. But there is no license through Department of Commerce, and so we are the licensing body. One taxpayer may hold multiple licenses. It's on the property that they're mining. There are no fees for the mining license. The business license, or as I mentioned, it's in lieu of the business license. And anyone that's operating without a mining license is guilty of a misdemeanor.
Any questions on that one? Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Could you remind, through the chair, what a typical business license for a corporation would cost?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, a business license is issued for 2 years, two consecutive years, and it's $100, so roughly $50 a year.
Thank you.
So on the slide 5, we have different mining license types that we issue. There's these various licenses are, as on the slide, coal, hard rock, open pit, placer, suction, dredging. I'll briefly explain these. The mining industry is in the room, so I'll let them explain more in depth. But coal mine, obviously, is for extracting coal. Hard rock is what you would think of in a common, when thinking of mining, it usually entails drilling mine shafts into a face of rock. Drilling and explosives are used. And once the rock is removed, it is crushed and the minerals are extracted. Open pit is just as it sounds. It's rather than digging a shaft, you just have a large open pit. I come from Utah. We have one of the largest open pit mines there. You can kind of see they've kind of created their own hills and almost mountain range there. And then placer is a mining which recovers valuable minerals from loose gravel. The usual form of transportation of minerals is through rivers and floods, and the method is to extract by separating from gravels, and that's often what you would think of as the panning for gold.
I just want to take a moment to recognize that Representative Rasmussen has joined us and that Commissioner Tangeman is in the audience. Thank you for joining us.
And then as the slide indicates, most of our licenses are actually for placer or suction mining. And then on to slide 7. There are different license categories. There's two separate licenses issued for an owner. You can be either an owner and operate your own mine. You can own and lease to have someone else operate your property. And then there's the lessee or operator that would be leasing the property from an owner. And those are the three different categories. And why that matters is that the owner of the property is the only one that can take the depletion deduction. And so we want to know who that is. On to slide 8. So who doesn't need a mining license? A mining license is not required for property being held for exploration. Someone that's holding a mineral interest in undeveloped or non-producing land, or if anyone that's mining sand and gravel, quarry rock, or earth. And that was originally taxable, but in 2012 it was that section was removed to exempt sand and gravel.
Okay.
And on to slide 9. So who needs to file a mining license tax return? So the easy answer is anyone holding a mining license needs to file a tax return, or anyone that should be holding a mining license. So basically, again, anyone that's extracting or attempting to extract valuable minerals from the earth. The owner, does need to get a license and to file a return, and that's also in the case if you're just a royalty recipient. That would be the owner lessor, and they do pay taxes on the royalties that they receive, and those that are paying the royalty gets that deduction in their tax return. On slide 10, the tax return is an annual tax return, just like an income tax return that you file with the Internal Revenue Service. It is due on a similar date rather than 3.5 months from the end of your tax year. It's 4 months from the end of your tax year. Or actually, the way the statute's written is before the first day of the fifth month, so basically at the end of the fourth month. And for a calendar year taxpayer, that would be April 30th. If you're a fiscal year taxpayer, it would be 4 months after the end of your fiscal year. We do have an extension similar to the Internal Revenue Service of 6 months. You just need to file a form with us, and you get that extension.
Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Spanos, who would be a fiscal year taxpayer as opposed to a regular calendar year taxpayer?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it would just depend on how the corporation's formed or the company, the entity. They would choose that fiscal year as opposed to a calendar year based on business practices. It's an election they make with the Internal Revenue Service, and they would have a fiscal year can be end of any month. It can be a 52-53 month period, or year end, 53-53 week period, and there's various fiscal year end dates, but it would be based on maybe if they're mining only in the summer, they want to have a fiscal year end right after the end of the summer.
Follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. So the majority of our mining companies that are paying taxes to us, the number is pretty small. Do you happen to know all of their fiscal years? Or so, you know, you running a report for us, February may only capture partial consideration of our mines. How do you account for, how does this keep you from going crazy? That every entity could have its own fiscal year determined, or are there, you know, so few that are actually paying it that it's just not driving you crazy at revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, taxes do often drive me crazy. luckily, we have a great new system. It was started development in 2014. We call it the Tax Revenue Management System. The legislature appropriated the money for that system, and thank you very much for that. It does help us remain a little bit more sane. We have better reporting, better confidence in our numbers and in our data. As far as fiscal year versus calendar year, in the mining tax world, there's roughly 500 taxpayers. In the corporate tax world, there's about 17,000 taxpayers. They also have calendar year and fiscal year end dates. Many more on fiscal years in that group than in the mining group. And our reports are fairly straightforward. We can run those reports and see who's on which. As far as tax payers in the mining tax, mining license tax that actually pay tax, it is a fairly small number. We have reported on that in the past, and I have the numbers today for the revenue in the slides, but I don't show the breakdown of how many like taxpayers are actually paying the tax. We could get that. And we do report on a fiscal year, the state's fiscal year. And so if the tax is received in the state's fiscal year, we're reporting into that fiscal year.
And thank you. That's where, as your commissioner sitting behind you, I was thinking of the revenue forecasting, but having to overlay this fiscal year predictions didn't seem to match the fall and spring forecast opportunities, and thought, but you guys got it all worked out, so I won't worry about it.
Did Representative Rouster, do you have a question?
No, ma'am, thank
you. Okay. I want to recognize that Representative Tuck has joined us. Please continue.
All right. And speaking of that tax revenue management system that we've implemented, we do that was started in 2014. Shortly thereafter, the legislature passed a statute that required all returns to be filed electronically. You can get a waiver to file from an electronic return, but in the mining tax world, it's the we have the most waivers. There, we get about 50% of our returns filed electronically, and the rest filed on paper. And there is a penalty if you don't have a waiver and you file on paper. It's $25 or 1% of the tax due. So in the case of the mining license, it's usually $25 that they're paying. The larger taxpayers that actually pay tax would either have a waiver or file timely, or rather file electronically, I should say. Okay, now we get into how does the mining license tax calculated. As I mentioned earlier in the presentation, it is a tax based on net income, and so you start with gross revenue or gross income, and then you have deductions from that. The gross income can include everything from the value you get for selling your mineral all the way up to the fair market value of the product that's shipped out of the state. The product is, if it's shipped out of the state, we can't track it any longer, and therefore the revenue is calculated based, or rather the income is calculated based on what you should have gotten when you shipped it out. But we lose nexus when it's sold in another state, so that's why that's in the statute. We have allowable deductions. Those include depletion, direct expenses, and indirect expenses. Direct expenses are things like royalties paid, fuel and oil, development costs, extraction costs, maintenance and repairs, salaries, transportation costs, depreciation and mining equipment. Indirect expenses could be advertising, insurance, legal and professional fees, office supplies, rent for the office, utilities, and overhead. And then expenses not allowed as a deduction, they include exploration costs, federal income tax, losses on the sale of mining equipment, net operating losses, and other capital losses.
We have a bunch of questions on this slide. So first is Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious if there's recently been any studies done about how Alaska's mining tax system compares to those in the lower 48.
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we haven't had any studies done. There have been other hearings in the past. Under the previous administration, there was a proposal to increase the tax. There were quite a few discussions around what that would look like. At one point, there was a proposal to create a task force to look at the structure of the tax and compare it to other states, but that never came to fruition.
Thank you.
Next is Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned allowable deductions. Did you say that exploration costs, no exploration costs at all, are deductible?
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, that's correct. There's a credit that's available that I'll get to later in the presentation for exploration costs.
Okay. Because I know, Madam Chair, I know a particular mine that spent millions of dollars in exploration costs. Just so they could expand. So, but none of those would count as a deduction against the mining license tax.
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I was just wondering, I know we have only six major mines, but I was wondering, of all the mines that we have in the state, how many are actually paying a tax?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I may need to use a lifeline on that one. The number is quite small, but I think it's around 10 of are the major taxpayers. But if Kelly Mazzei could correct me if I'm wrong.
Ms. Mazzei, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Kelly Mazzei. I'm the manager of excise tax with the Tax Division and Department of Revenue, and I have some numbers from a couple years ago that we broke out in tax brackets, and we had 10 taxpayers that were in the uppermost tax bracket that had a net income of over $100,000. We had 19 taxpayers that had a net income between $40,000 and $100,000. And what we did was we combined the 3% and the 5% brackets for purposes of confidentiality. And we had the majority of taxpayers, about 400 taxpayers that were between zero and 40,000, and therefore they did not pay a tax. So Brandon was correct, the 10 taxpayers at the uppermost bracket of 7% over 100,000.
Thank you.
No follow-up?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. I just had a question about the definition of depletion.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I actually have a slide on that.
Sweet. Okay. We'll wait for that. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, you were saying that that you're looking at the sales price or the value we may have received if sold here in Alaska, but how it's assumed. Has that been tested to make sure that that would be the value?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, if we are the ones that are setting that fair market value, are you saying if the tax division sets that value, or are we verifying it through audit?
Actually, both. Actually, how is that value set? Then I guess the first question, and then if it's tested or audited to make sure that it's correct.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, if we have a taxpayer that's regularly exporting, generally it is sold somewhere, and we would base it on that value. That's if it's an arm length transaction. If it's not an arm's length transaction, we would look at what it's sold for in the market. Again, the number of taxpayers is fairly small, and we are able to work with the taxpayers if we have those questions. If it's in the course of an audit, generally we'll try to take the state's best interest to heart, and when we're looking at that fair market value, but the taxpayer always has appeal rights and can dispute that if they disagree.
Okay, and if I may, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Does that happen very often? Or you guys get it pretty?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I'd say that happened more often when we were dealing with sand and gravel, the fair market value issue. Mm-hmm. That they didn't export a lot, but there was a fair market value calculation. I can't recall off the top of my head it being a dispute issue in recent years.
Sure. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any else? Okay. Representative Rodriguez.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. For your purposes, how do you define an arm's length sale?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, arm's length would be that there's the third party involved. So that if a corporation or an entity is selling to another entity and that is a sister corporation or sister entity, that wouldn't be an arm's length transaction. So it would be based on ownership of a parent company or of either company.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
So moving on to slide 12. As I promised, we have actually a few slides on depletion. Depletion is the term we use for depreciation of a mineral property used to extract a natural resource. And the depletion costs are capitalized when depleted using one of two allowable methods, or rather, development costs are capitalized and then depleted using one of two methods, either cost or percentage depletion. Both of those are defined in statute, in the Alaska statutes. Taxpayers may use either method. In fact, the statute says that they can use the one that gives them the most benefit. And the percentage depletion can't go over 50%. I'll actually delve into that a little bit here in the next couple slides. So the statute basically reads and says that a taxpayer gets percentage depletion and then says unless cost depletion is more favorable. And so I'll start with cost depletion because it's the more traditional method. So total development costs are allowed to be deducted over an estimated life of the mine. And once all development costs are deducted or depleted, the cost depletion expense is no longer allowed. So basically you deplete it until its value is recaptured. It is, as I mentioned, limited to the cost basis of the mine. The depletion rate is the cost basis divided by the estimated number of recoverable units, and then the depletion rate is multiplied by the number of units sold to calculate it.
We have a question from Representative Rauscher and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I was just wondering, next to the oil industry, what's the second largest taxpayer we have out there as far as the resources?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, determined based on how much revenue is received?
Well, I guess it would be based on the amount of taxes they have to pay based on their revenue. You know what I'm saying? It's the percentage, I guess.
So I'd probably want to get back to you on that, but I can take a quick glance at the fishing industry pays in the business, the fishing business tax, about $46 million in 2018, and in the resource landing tax, $9.7 million. And then they have other taxes I won't delve into. In fact, we're coming back on Wednesday to present the fisheries industry taxes, and we can get more into that. The mining license tax, I have a slide further on. Let me just peek ahead, is $47.2 million, or roughly $47.3 million in FY18. So fishing industry would have paid more in 2018.
Through the chair. So the largest ones is mining and fishing, is that it?
I believe that's correct, through the chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I was just wondering, I guess that'll be all right for now.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. You said that the depletion costs are calculated over the life of the mine. And is that the permitted life of the mine? How do you determine how many years that depletion is going to be taken out of?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, so there are, again, two different types of depletion. This cost depletion is, I may have said over the life of the mine, but it is actually depleted over the estimated life of the mine. So they would estimate the recoverable units, and that's what's used to calculate the depletion until it's fully depleted. You could continue to operate after the depletion is taken.
Hello?
Could you help me understand who would tell you what the estimated life of the mine is? Is that the operator? Is it the agencies giving them a permit or some other factor to determine that?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it would be the operator. So they would have specialists that would determine how many recoverable units there are.
And then, do you know if typically the life of the mine expenditure matches what they're permitted for? Is that typical, or?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we see cost depletion fully depleted and mine still operating. So I'm not sure what's, I would have to do a analysis of that to see if that's typical.
Okay.
And through the chair, perhaps the industry would be able to respond to that better than I could.
Okay, thank you.
So moving on to slide 14, this is the percentage depletion. This one is fairly straightforward. It's based on a percentage of the gross income, and it's spelled out in statute on what that percentage is based on what type of mineral you're extracting. So for coal mines, for instance, it's 10%, and then for sulfur mines, it's 23%. The depletion deduction is capped at 50% of the net income of the taxpayer, and this one can be taken after the cost method is fully after the costs are fully depleted from the development of the mine. And any questions on that slide?
If I may, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So it sounds like you can use both of these methods. I thought it was one or the other, but this sounds like you can use both methods.
So through the chair, Representative Tuck, you get one or the other in each year. So you can use both over various years, but for 1 year, you get one method.
Okay, thank you.
Whichever is the most beneficial to you.
Okay.
So slide 15 is the exemption. This is the 3.5 year exemption that we spoke about earlier. Since, and I apologize, it's actually not in the slide, it's on my notes here. But since 2001, Department of Revenue has received approximately 26 exemptions requested, and 19 of those were denied. 7 have been granted. The exemption is in statute. It spells out what it's basically for a new mine operation. And so an affidavit needs to be filed with the Department of Natural Resources and claiming if it basically spelling out why it would be a new mine. DNR then and analyzes that and lets us know if they believe that it is a new mining operation. If it does fall under the definition of a new mine, they can get that 3.5-year exemption. And some things that might go into that determination or considerations are whether it's prior owner has paid taxes, the location of the mine, geological structure, mining techniques and technology, and new capital invested.
We have a question from Representative Rauscher.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I was just wondering, Deputy Director, what was the reason, an average reason, for why they might have been denied?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, if the land has been mined previously, so that if it's already been mined, they can't claim it's a new mine.
And so that's basically why those 9 were failed. Okay, thanks.
Do you know? I didn't get a chance to write those numbers down quickly enough. So it was some number of applications, some number of denials, and 7 approvals. So you think that group of denials was pretty exclusively because of there had been a prior mine operation there before?
Madam Chair, I would actually need to either use a lifeline or get back to you on the specific reasons, but typically that is the reason that's really what the statute says, is either if the tax has been paid on it before, that's an indication that it's obviously been mined before. And so all the categories that we're looking at are trying to determine whether this is a new mining operation or they're simply starting up a mine again.
Okay. Do you want me to check with?
Sure, we can start with Kelly Mazzei.
Okay, Ms. Mazzei.
Hi, for the record, this is Kelly Mazzei. And from my experience, most of the time that the exemptions are denied, it is because, as Brandon mentioned, it's not considered a new mining operation. Some of the reasons could have to do with the technology use and what type of new capital is invested. And so sometimes the applicant believes that they spent a significant amount of money to consider the maybe new technology, new mining technology, new assets to be enough to consider it a new technology and a new mining operation. However, unless they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it is a brand new technology and not just paying to maintain or to repair old technology, most likely they'll be denied. Also, the other reason would be if they try to expand on a mining location and perhaps that area had not been mined before, so they think it's a new mining operation. However, if it's adjacent or could be considered part of a previous mining operation, that would probably be denied also.
Okay. We have a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And through the chair, I'm going to ask my first one of Kelly Mazzei. So a mine operation doesn't have to be entirely new. It could be in the same we'll pick on you, Sibeli, because they're sitting here in the room and they've been there a long time. But if they just moved to an expansion on their property, it may or may not be considered a new mine. If they've reached out into new boundaries but in areas that they've mined before, depending on other circumstances. So it doesn't have to be an entirely new property. It could be using new technology in a new shaft. And I know that Usability doesn't typically have shafts. So I'm mixing my mines. I guess I could pick on my district. So some of those, maybe Kensington, if they've got a new ore discovery, but they've got their same structure, shoreside, topside, but underground, they've gone into a new vein. it could be a new mine, even though topside they've got the same physical plant operating it. But when they had to file to go another 100 yards in another direction to get to that vein of ore, they may be a new mine for that.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, you are correct. Right, from our regulations, maybe the wording, maybe I'm not explaining, it might be easier for me just to read a part of this, which is they look at the geological structure of the ore body in relation to other ore bodies the person mines, also the mining techniques and technology used, and then lastly, they also look at the extent to which the person is required to invest new capital, employ different personnel, and use additional facilities to exploit the resource. So I think what you're saying is correct, and we're all in agreement at some of the things, the criteria that are used to determine the eligibility for the exemption, but some of it can become quite complicated, and DNR, if during their presentation, they might be able to help out a little bit more with some of the things they look at. The exemption statute is actually under Title 38 under Department of Natural Resources, and they usually look at the details of the mining operation a little bit more than we do in tax and make a recommendation, and it can go into several pages to describe even one of the small criteria, like what you were talking about, how they're actually mining, whether it's above or below, and that could take a lot of explanation, I suppose you could say. So it can get complicated. It's not necessarily black and white. It can take quite a bit of research and geographical mapping in order to even try to come up with a determination.
Okay, thank you. I had another question on the other, which I think is for Mr. Spanos, which is the 3.5-year exemption. Is that common to do most states that have operational mines have that long of an exemption?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I'm going to have to plead ignorance. I don't know if other states have an exemption for new mines, but I can look into it and get back to you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any other? Representative Rasmussen.
I guess to follow up that question, I would be curious if you could also look at the amount of time, or I guess as a committee we can look at that, because from my understanding in a previous presentation, I thought it was like 15 or 16 or 17 years from start to having the permits and everything done. So the amount of time that it takes Alaska to get to the permitting process through this, for the start of their project versus the lower 48, I think is also something for us to be considering.
Right.
Please continue.
All right. So slide 16. This is the mining tax credits. There are a few different credits, starting with the, I believe it was Representative Tuck had asked about the, maybe it was Tallarico had asked about a exploration incentive credit. And a person may receive a credit for exploration costs incurred up to $20 million. And those costs include what's listed here on the slide, like surveying and drilling exploration holes. There's also education credit. That credit has been expanded and extended in both 2011 and in 2014. And there have only been four taxpayers that have taken that or claimed that education tax credit in the mining license tax type. Most of those are claimed in the corporate income tax side.
We have a question from Representative Tuck and then Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, when is that expiration incentive credit approved? Is it before activity takes place, during activity, or when is that approved by the state?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, it's claimed on the tax return, so it would be after the fact. To my knowledge, we don't approve those credits, but I'm afraid I'll have to use a lifeline again to verify that.
Sure. Ms. Mazzei?
Hi, this is Kelly Mazzei.
Mazzei, pardon me.
So the Alaska Exploration Incentive Credit, the exploration expenses are incurred before applying for the credit and taking it on the tax return. we do have this form 665, and it's also available to the corporate income taxpayers and through DNR's production royalty tax. So the expiration, any expenses that are incurred have already been paid or already incurred or accrued before the credit can be taken.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, when I read this, I was reading, must be applied within 15 tax years of credit approval, and I was thinking applied. You actually mean used, not applied for. And then when I saw approval, so I thought it was something you applied for, and then you got approval. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair to the Deputy Director, how much has the exploration tax credit actually cost the state? Do you have any idea? And is that a number you can get?
So through the chair, Representative Rauscher, in the mining license tax type, we've actually not had any claims of that credit. So there, again, it's available with the royalties tax as well as the corporate income tax, and I could get back to you on how much has been claimed in those tax types. But from the mining tax, we haven't had any.
And to that follow-up, so if you could, and how much have those mines contributed to the state revenue itself? That would be something I'd like to know also.
Those that, just to clarify through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for those that have claimed the credit?
Yeah. Okay. I believe those, through the chair. You mentioned four, and I don't know which ones the four are, but you mentioned there were four, and I was just wondering how those, the state benefited from those.
So through the chair, Representative Rauscher, the four that I mentioned were had claimed the education tax credit, and and not the exploration incentive tax credit.
Then the exploration tax credit, the mines that benefited from it.
Those again, through the chair, we haven't had any mines claim the exploration
Zero.
Tax credit in the mining tax type. That's correct. Zero.
Thank you,
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, help me understand the education tax credit.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I wish I had written better notes on that one because going from memory, it's changed enough that I'll likely miss. I'll bet that Kelly has it in front of her, so maybe I'll defer to her. But basically, you get a certain portion of your first $100,000 that you spend. I think it may be up to 100% now, and then you get a portion of the next $100,000 that you spend, but I'll let Kelly.
But excuse me.
Clarify.
So to clarify, spend where? I mean, are they contributing to a school district, or their workers got masters in geology, or?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's for contributions to education, so that includes secondary education, and so colleges are generally the largest recipients of the. Donations.
Okay. So if they donate money to the UA, College of Mines comes to think that it might be a common place that they donate to, then they can use that donation as a deduction on their tax credit, on their taxes.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, they get it as a credit, correct? And it could be to that, it could be to a nonprofit that has an education charter, and there's it's been expanded to fit more than just the traditional colleges.
And it, excuse me, through the chair, it does encapsulate school districts, though, K-12 districts. I'm seeing my mind shaking their heads, so. Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
And when we had the UAF professor speak to us, he talked a little bit about it here at UAS. I think a couple, Greens Creek donates, for example, to the mining certification program. So. We can try to get a little more information about that. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. Is there any way for companies to have a fund that reimburses their employees for education? I know a lot of big companies do that, but is there something that they could then apply for the education exemption if they were paying tuition directly for an employee or, you know, participating in a program like that?
Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen. a company would need to take care to structure it so that they so that it is a charitable contribution.
Okay.
If they just pay for an employee's education, that wouldn't be considered a contribution to a charitable organization. So they could structure it that they could set up a nonprofit, give the contribution to the nonprofit, and have that nonprofit determine where that money goes, which could be for their employees.
Thank you. Okay. I just on this exploration incentive credit, I was thinking, I was surprised that no one has applied for that. And I'm just trying to remember, is that a new addition to the tax structure or?
Madam Chair, no, it's not new. We just find that most of the education credits are claimed in the corporate income tax world. They're available in many different tax types, including mining and the oil and gas production, oil and gas property. But again, they're claimed on the corporate tax return generally.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for the education tax credit.
Correct.
I'm sorry, for the exploration incentive credit. Because what I'm trying to determine, because there's the 3.5 year exemption, I guess, is it that you have to choose to use one or the other? Because, you know, from day one you become operational. I'm trying to figure out why you wouldn't want to have this exploration credit applied against your taxes, except there'd be a circumstance where mathematically, I guess, it would disadvantage you to use that over another. Is that what we think is happening?
Madam Chair, I can look more into it, but I suspect that they're claiming it in a different tax type. I'm more familiar with the education tax credit, mm-hmm. and that one is limited to the calculation that I can't remember off the top of my head. But basically, you can't take the same credit in multiple tax types. You can only take it on one tax return, or you could break it up over multiple tax returns, but it's just simpler to take it on one.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that's what's happening with the exploration tax credit.
Okay.
But we can analyze it a bit and get back to you.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you. And we'll share it with committee members. Sure. Any other questions on this one? Okay, please continue.
So moving on to slide 17. This is out of our couple different annual reports. Our annual report looks back 3 years. This one looks back five. And so this is the revenue from fiscal years 2018 back to 2014. And our we got that tax revenue management system rolled out in 2014. So 2015 data, we're very comfortable with. 2014, you can see the tax payer number is quite a bit lower. We think some of that just is not great reporting in our older system. But as you can see in FY18, it was 47.3 million roughly of tax collected, and that was from 423 tax returns. But as Ms. Mazet explained earlier, the majority of those are paid by 10 companies.
Okay, Representative Hopkins, then Hannon, then Spanholz have questions.
Thank you. Yeah, looking at this chart, it's a pretty up and down amount of money that's come into the state from this 5 year comparison of revenue, as well as new mines that seem to inversely relate to the amount of money came in. So why did we go from 23 to 38 to $10 million to 41 to 46, and especially that $10 million year when we had 503 applicants? What causes such a discrepancy year to year?
So Representative Hopkins, through the chair, I can say that the number of taxpayers does not correlate at all to the revenue, and that's because, again, we have primarily 10 taxpayers that are paying that revenue. So the large number of licenses we see could just be suction dredgers in Nome, and maybe some of them. We have had a hard time getting certain taxpayers to get a license with us, so it might be that they just wanted to be compliant that year, and the next year they decided not to be compliant. And so we may have the exact same number of actual miners from year to year and just different licenses from year to year. So really, I think the revenue is probably the better thing to look at. It is dependent upon the value of the minerals that's being sold. So if zinc prices go down, revenue is going to go down. Also, if coal or gold go up, then revenue is going to go up because it is a net income based tax, and so it's not based on how much it's mined. It obviously that's a factor, but it is very much based on what the net income of the business is.
So, does that mean that there was a 75% drop in the value of the commodities sold in Alaska that year for FY 2016?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, it may not correlate that directly. It might be that they had that yes, commodity prices did go down, but their expenses could have gone up. There's the other factors that could weigh into that. I may ask that the industry help me out with that one a little bit, because again, we're the revenue collector. We see things after the fact. We do obviously verify numbers, but we don't necessarily have the expertise as to what factors drove the drop in their net income.
Thank you. I'll make sure to ask.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Those were my questions.
Oh, beautiful. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is the CBR, is that the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund that we see here?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, that's correct.
And those are as a result of litigation?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, the constitutional language would lead you to think that, but it's actually been interpreted by the courts to mean that it's that the beginning of a litigation is an assessment. And so if we do any audit assessment or revenue letter increase, even those $25 penalties, those are all assessments for not electronically filing your return. All of those would be into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund once paid.
Okay, and if I may, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So any of the assessments that has gone to court goes into the CBR fund automatically.
So through the Chair, Representative Tuck, that was our interpretation at one time, but the Hickel v. Halford decision stated that it didn't even have to go to court. So long as we sent them a notice and demand for payment, that was the beginning of the litigation, whether a litigation actually happened or not, and therefore we need to transfer the money into the Constitutional Budget Reserve if they make a payment on an assessment. So basically, any assessment would in the mining tax would be paid into the CBR.
And one last follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't have to go to court, but any assessment that's done by a review committee or just a simple audit? Or how is the assessments, the final assessments determined?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, it would could be just a simple audit.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And to add to that, it would be, through the Chair, it would just be a notice and demand for payment. So if it shows up on that demand, then it would be considered CBR.
Okay. Thank you.
Just quickly check my notes to make sure I don't have anything to add to that slide. I think we covered it all. And that is actually my last slide. So thank you for your time and for the opportunity to present.
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to review with you the questions that I heard for follow-up. So there was a question about how many taxpayers. I think now we have the revenue, but Representative Rauscher had the question about how many taxpayers. And then also a question about revenue, but I think that's been covered now. Representative Rauscher, if there's something else, please let us know. And then question about the use of the credits, the education credit versus the exploration incentive, and you said you could look into a little more detail on that for us. And then there was the questions from Representative Hannon and Rasmussen about the 3.5-year exemption versus the time in comparison to the timeline for how long it takes for a mine to come online.
And I, you don't see me writing down, Madam Chair, but I do have somebody listening and taking notes for
okay.
me. So
that's why I have to write them down, too.
Yep. So we'll be sure to respond to all those questions.
Okay, excellent. We really appreciate your presentation. Just a very brief at ease to change presenters. Thank you.
Thank you.
PM. Welcome to our presenters for the mining industry update, and we'll try and do the same thing, and I'm just going to have to be very mindful of time because we have this shortened time, and apologies for that. But thank you for being here. If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and putting yourself on the record.
This is Karen Mathias. I'm the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers, and I'll start with a safety moment, and then Deantha will start the presentation. In the interest of time, we're going to condense quite a few of our things. So my safety moment is, if you take a tour of a mine, please take the safety glasses home with you and use them.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is Deantha Crockett, and I'm the executive director of the Alaska Miners Association. So today, Karen and I are going to talk to you about why we mine and talk about our dependency on mine products, We're going to show you where we mine and give you an overview of Alaska's mining industry. We're going to highlight the industry's environmental practices and the laws that govern us. And then I'll turn it over to Karen to go through our economic benefits and the data surrounding the economics of mining in Alaska. And I'm going to kind of rush through these because Karen and I got the sense that there's a lot of economic questions that we're prepared to. So I'm going to kind of rush. Please stop me if at any point I'm going too fast. I do want to show you this slide because we think it's critically important to reflect upon the fact that all of us are dependent on the extraction of minerals for the mine products we depend on. Whether we want to admit it or not, there's a lot of things that we so vitally need or we find to be convenient or part of our quest for new technologies that comes from mining, and that's really why we're doing this in the first place. So here I've got a slide that is a photo of the Fire Island Wind Farm in Cook Inlet. And certainly renewable energy is a timely topic right now. And no matter what source of renewable energy we may be talking about, the infrastructure for any of it takes a substantial amount of minerals. Solar panels, hybrid vehicles take almost twice as much copper as a traditional vehicle. So as we look to pursue greater results in renewable energy for our planet, mining industry has a huge part to play in that. So for an everyday perspective, here is a graphic of metals that could be in your iPhone. You can see up here gold, silver, copper, tungsten, et cetera. And with three primary gold producers and one of the top silver producers in the United States operating here in Alaska, it's really possible that Alaska minerals can be in your phone. So a look at where we mine. I'm going to review the map on the screen here for a little bit. You guys also have a centerfold, the thing that we passed out to you, the four-page brochure. The centerfold of that has this, so you don't have to crane your neck there. But you can see, I'm going to go from north to south, and you can see that our operations are depicted with those red stars. Our projects and permitting are those blue triangles, and our advanced exploration projects are those green stars. So very quickly, the Red Dog Mine is the largest lead and zinc producer in the United States. They've got about 600 employees at that mine that's on Nana Regional Corporation land. Fort Knox is our largest producing gold mine. It's now in its 23rd year of operation, and they've got 640 employees that drive each day to work at the mine and go home at the end of the day. And this year, they expanded into their Gilmore deposit, which will extend the life of that mine. Pogo is our only mine located entirely on state of Alaska land. They've been mining since 2006 and are currently the eighth largest gold producer in the United States. And last year, the mine was acquired by a company called Northern Star Resources, which is a company new to Alaska. They've got 320 employees. The Usabelli Coal Mine, our state's only coal mine, has been operating since 1943, and today they have right around 100 people that work at the mine, which provides for 39% of interior Alaska's electricity generation. The Kensington Mine began producing gold in 2010, and they're currently undergoing exploration to extend the life of that mine. They've got 387 employees, and they're Southeast Alaska's second largest private employer in terms of payroll. Greens Creek is the largest silver producer in the United States and one of the top 10 producers worldwide. They are the largest private employer in Southeast in terms of payroll with 420 employees. And we've got two projects in permitting currently. One is Donlin Gold, and they saw a final environmental impact statement and joint record of decision from BLM and the Corps of Engineers late last year. They're anticipating 1,000 production jobs depending on that production timeline, and during their camp operations had a 90% Shalista Corporation shareholder hire rate. The other is Pebble, and I understand that you've had a number of presentations on Pebble, so in the interest of time, I'll move on. Our advanced exploration projects, there's a lot of exploration that goes on in the state of Alaska, but these are considered advanced, meaning that they're looking at the viability and economic feasibility of those projects. So Upper Kobuk Mineral Projects, this is taking place on Nana Regional Corporation land, and they've had very extensive exploration activity and pre-feasibility studies. Graphite Creek is a graphite, you might have guessed, deposit near Nome, who is also looking at their economic assessment. Live and Good, a gold deposit north of Fairbanks, is recently completed a second pre-feasibility study. And the Palmer Project near Haines is a zinc, copper, gold, and silver deposit, and they're also going through a preliminary economic assessment. So what isn't pictured on this map, and because it would be quite busy, are our placer mining operations. And I think Mr. Spanos did a great job outlining those. I just want to point out, you know, while they're typically much smaller in nature, there are over 200 active placer mines today. So those do have a big impact on Alaska. And then finally, while this map is in front of you, I just want to call your attention to the yellow dots that are all over the state. These are communities where mining industry employees live. Karen's going to expand on that data in a few moments, but I wanted you to have a picture of how geographically spread out our environmental opportunities are.
Okay, two questions here. Representative Rasmussen, then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. Mine's super brief. For the plaster mines, do you have a quick number for what that means in terms of jobs and what it brings economically to the state just for the plaster mines?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, we do. A couple of years ago, we actually did an economic benefits of just the plaster mining industry because our plaster miners for a long time told us we have more than six large mines. We have a seventh large mine in aggregate. And it turns out they're absolutely right. There's well over 1,100 jobs. The economic benefits in terms of wages, in terms of procurement, and taxes paid are very similar to one of our large mines. So, and I can get you specific numbers on that.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. So Live and Good brings to mind that it's an area where we've been mining there for over 100 years, I assume mostly small individual plaster miners. Is it likely that it will be considered a new mine when it comes online because this is a new corporation developing it versus 50 different guys 100 years ago?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, you're correct in that Live and Good was discovered as a result of placer operation. They found a lode deposit and determined that there could be the resources there to develop a large mine. It would be different investors. It would be a different permitting system altogether. And I can't say in certainty. I can certainly get you an answer, but it would be a very new type of mining, new application of mining, et cetera. So why mine here in Alaska? And we contend that we do a superb job at it. Our operations and the agencies that regulate them account for what is a world-class regulatory system. Our mines are permitted for the protection of all aspects of the environment, so air, land, water, fish and wildlife, and human health. There's strict regulatory oversight throughout the mine life, but it doesn't end when the mine closes. There's extensive planning that takes place beforehand for closure, and then continued oversight of the mine post-closure for reclamation to restore the site. And there's tailored financial assurance, meaning that if for some reason the state must step in and perform that reclamation, the money is there to cover the cost. So here's a fast look at what it takes to permit a mine in Alaska, and this information is supplied by the Department of Natural Resources.
We have a question from Representative Hopkins, and I didn't see it.
I was too late. It was my fault. On the last slide, just real quickly, you said we had a world-class, that the environmental regulatory system. What did you say was a world-class here in Alaska in terms of the regulatory system?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, yes, I was referring to our regulatory system, and I apologize if I wasn't specific. But when we say that, it is because there are a number of cases, and I'll get into those in just a moment, of where Alaska really goes above and beyond in terms of its permitting and oversight of mining operations. So again, this is just an example, and this information comes from the Department of Natural Resources the approval process to permit a large mine in Alaska. And you can see that there are dozens of local, state, and federal government agencies that are involved in this process. So the permits that are listed on this screen are what's typical for a mine that is being permitted on state or privately held land. A mine that is on federally owned land would actually have a significant number of additional permits, such as those that are under the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service mining regulations. These permits are just a list of the permits, but they also contain multiple stipulations that are in addition to the compliance with our statutes and regulations. And what I mean when I say this is that our permitting agencies can, and they very often do, prescribe additional practices to the operations to be performed that are outside of our governing laws. One of the most important things to understand about this permitting process and all of these permits being obtained by a developer is that it doesn't guarantee approval. Achieving each and every one of these is very much a back and forth project between the developer and the agencies. There's no automatic yes. They've got to go back and forth to get that tailor-made plan to be the right fit for that operation. And throughout this process, there are multiple opportunities for public participation. So I mentioned...
Representative Hopkins has a question.
Thanks. In terms of the state permits that are required, how does that compare to other states? I mean, I'm going to guess that there's still air quality permits you have to get, water rights permits, fish and habitat and fishery permits, and all those sort of things. How does that list compare to other states?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair, and chair, I apologize. I'll stop before I flip to the next slide and make sure there's no questions. So I mentioned that this is typical for a mine that is being permitted on either state or privately owned land. So I would say this is specific to Alaska, this slide here that's provided to us by the Department of Natural Resources. the federal mines being permitted on federal land would have a lot of similarities, but our mines being permitted on state land or privately owned land, I think, would be more specific to Alaska, and I think we can provide you a side-by-side comparison of that.
Thank you. That'd be great. So you don't.
I feel like any answer. I apologize. I feel like any answer I would give you would be hypothetical, and I'd rather give you one that was more specific.
All right. I'll thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Please continue.
Thank you. So I mentioned that our permitting system is unique, and one of the really special parts about that is we do have one of the best water quality monitoring systems in the world with respect to mines. We've got some unique requirements that set us apart from other jurisdictions. And our system here has three distinct parts. And first, we do water quality monitoring, which is fairly standard. But in Alaska, we take a further step, which is fairly uncommon with other jurisdictions, and we do biomonitoring. So our Department of Fish and Game oversees monitoring of algae, of the benthic environment, so the crustaceans, et cetera, and fish, including the metals, their metals uptake, their habitat, and their population. And the third part is that Alaska requires a third-party audit, and this is a transparent public process that not only monitors the company's compliance, but also the agencies that monitor the company's reporting and results. I don't know of any other place that does all three of these things in this grade of detail, so it really does set Alaska above in terms of how we do water quality monitoring.
Representative Rauscher has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Ms. Crockett, I was wondering, is Red Dog Creek, it's kind of unique, is what how the water is actually now improved than before we got there. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, you're absolutely right. Red Dog is a special has a special story to tell in which the naturally occurring mineralization that was in the water bodies there before a mine was taking place. It was a rich mineralized zone, and so the water was completely void of aquatic life. It wasn't hospitable to life because it was so high in mineral content. When the mine went in and the water quality that was required of the mine, the water treatment that took place, it actually cleaned up that stream, if you will, Red Dog Creek, and made it very hospitable to a number of different forms of life. The aquatic insects, the vegetation around the stream got a lot better and made it more stable, and now it has some really great fish populations and other environmental enhancements that came from that, simply as a result of that mine there being required to treat the wastewater that came out into that stream.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you explain the three pictures that we have?
Yes. So this.
I mean, you're not catching headless fish up there, right?
Excuse Representative Tuck, through the chair, it's a pretty sad looking fish in terms of size. The one on the left here is phytoplankton. So when I talked about the benthic environment, measuring the very small species there, the middle is aquatic insects, and the right, of course, is fish. So those are the three parts. The three species, if you will, that the Department of Fish and Game is monitoring when they're doing water quality monitoring around the site of a mine.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Yeah.
So just to quickly hone in on an above and beyond example of Alaska mines doing it right, I mentioned earlier that oftentimes there are things done well outside the governing statutes and regulations. And the Fish Creek near the Fort Knox mine is a great example. Here we saw placer mining that had taken place during the Fairbanks gold rush of the 1900s. It left behind an area that was pretty barren and uninhabitable to the fish populations that are native to the area. And even though it wasn't an area that Fort Knox operated in, development of the mine created opportunities to fix the damage and to revitalize the fisheries. So the mine worked with the Department of Fish and Game to construct the stream channels that you can see in that upper right photo, which provided for fish passage between the isolated ponds that were there. And this activity went to diversify the vegetation from the mainly black spruce that you can see on the hillsides to add shrubs and other willows and vegetation that the moose really love. And this area really resulted in a fish and wildlife sanctuary, and it's got some prize-sized fish that you can see in this photo on the top left. That is an ADF&G employee. And at the time of performing this restoration, the agency had a target to reach the goal of the fish size and the fish population at the end of the Fort Knox mine life, and they achieved it in 2 years. And they jointly received environmental awards for this work. And summaries of this monitoring is actually done in annual reports on DNR's website, so you can see how this project is ongoing and the success that continues today from this enhancement project. And my last slide, talking about reclamation and closure. Alaska law requires that a mine's plan for reclamation and closure be approved by DNR before operations can begin. So in addition to being required to get that approval of the reclamation plan, mines also have to provide financial assurance in the event that the obligations can't be performed. And that amount of that financial assurance is also required to be approved before operations begin. Financial assurance is required by all companies. It doesn't matter where they're headquartered, and all mines, no matter what kind of land status they're on. We also have another interesting situation in which third-party reviewers evaluate not only the operation and the reclamation plan, but the oversight of the state and federal agency that's regulating the operation and is approving that reclamation plan. So this is another area where we shine because we're the only state that does this in terms of mining. So I apologize for being quick, but I know you want to talk economics, so I'll turn the presentation over to Karen to discuss those. Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is Karen Mathias again from the Council of Alaska Producers. The first few slides have to do with the recent economic impact study that the McDowell Group prepared for the Alaska Miners Association. There's a lot of really good statistics in here, and rather than read them all to you, I'm just going to highlight a couple of things from each slide. For this one, 4,500 direct jobs at the mines, but then there's an additional thousands of jobs that come from people working in transportation, environmental management, camp services, all jobs that are paid for by the mine, but they may not be direct employees. Those jobs in the mining industry have an average salary of $102,000. That's about twice the state average. So those are really good family-supporting jobs. They also tend to be year-round, and many of them are in rural areas. So there's a real regional implication for mining in Alaska. The main point that I want you to take from this slide is the importance of mining to regions, and we'll touch on this throughout the presentation. In addition to all of the employees, those little yellow dots you saw on the map that Diantha pointed out, there's also a lot of businesses that contract, obviously, with the large mines, and the last numbers we have show about $500 million in procurement with local Alaska businesses.
I just had one question on this slide. Do we know the resident versus non-resident hire for the direct jobs by chance?
We do, and I have a slide on that later if you like.
Yeah, we can wait.
But so I can go into more detail on that.
That sounds great.
I know that Lance Miller spoke for the Alaska Minerals Commission a couple of weeks ago, and he provided some really excellent information about the social and economic impact of Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska. So I won't try to repeat what he said. The data is there, but the story of mining in rural Alaska is so much more than just the data, because Red Dog in particular has had such an impact on a positive impact on people's lives in northwestern Alaska. In terms of shareholder hire, you've got 55% of the employees are NANA shareholders. But the important thing is that NANA, when they set out the agreement for constructing the mine back in the 1980s, they didn't just want jobs. They didn't just want royalties. They also wanted opportunities for their people to work in the mine and to have contracting opportunities. So it's really a threefold economic impact, in addition to ensuring that they maintained strong oversight for marine mammal protection and an environmental subsistence committee. So it's more than just data when you look at the impact of Red Dog Mine. And then local and state government revenue, and I'll get into more detail about this, but big picture, you've got $34 million in local government revenue, and of course the city and borough of Juneau, you've got its two largest taxpayers are from the mining industry, Fairbanks and Northwest Arctic Borough, also largest taxpayers are mines in the area, and mining is very important in many other regions too, like Nome, Healy, Delta Junction. Total of $103 million in 2018 to state government, and additional $46 million in other state government related revenue, and I'll break that out for you in a couple of slides. So one of the things that we think is really important to be aware of is the net benefit of mining to the state of Alaska. This study was done by the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Social and Economic Research, and it took a five-year average because, as Representative Hopkins pointed out in a previous slide, there's a lot of ups and downs when it comes to mining. So they took a five-year average to look at, as you'll see the column on the left, the dark blue is how much revenue the state took in from mining on a yearly average. And then the light blue on top adds the local government revenue to that. So as you can see, it's over $100 million. And then this much smaller column on the right, the bottom is the operational costs to the state of Alaska for its management and oversight of the mining industry, managing all of the paperwork, the fees, the leasing, all of that kind of thing. And a very small red amount at the top is capital budget. So as you can see, obviously, there's a very great net benefit in terms of what mining provides to the state versus what it costs the state to manage and oversee the mining industry. And one of the reasons for that is that the state is able to bill its permitting, monitoring, and oversight costs to the mining companies. I've got a slide on that later to get into a little bit more detail about that, but that's one of the reasons that amount is so much smaller. It's not coming from the general fund. So land ownership really matters when it comes to revenue, and this slide reminds us that the state only gets a royalty payment if the mine is on state land. Red Dog Mine, for example, is on NANA land, so NANA gets the royalty. All of the mines, however, pay the Alaska Mining License Tax and also corporate income tax. This splits out that number I gave you before, $148.6 million in state revenue in 2018. This information is also in the McDowell brochure. As you can see, not quite half of it is the Alaska Mining License Tax, rent, and royalties, and then the other two major players there are the corporate income tax and also the receipts to ADA for the use of the Red Dog port and road system, and also the Skagway ore terminal.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you. This actually goes back to the mining revenue. Of the six large producing mines in Alaska, I know Red Dog's entirely on Native Corporation land. Are any of the others, or are they all on state, are the other five on state land?
So I just flipped ahead to a slide on land status, which lists the five metal mines. And, of course, Usabelli Coal Mine is the sixth large mine. And it's also on the front page of that McDowell brochure. And that shows the land status. So only Pogo and Usabelli operate exclusively on state land, and the royalties go directly to the state. There's obviously Fort Knox and Kensington have a portion of their land as state land, but they're also operating on land with other ownership. And then there are others that are not operating on state land at all.
Okay. Thank you.
And then I think what I'll do in the interest of time is try to have you finish the slides, and then we'll try to have it maybe at least 5 minutes for questions if possible.
Sure. And I'm sorry, I was supposed to say Representative Hannon through the chair. It's been a little while since I've done this. My apologies. So Representative Hopkins, this is another way of looking at that Alaska Mining License Tax number. And I have another slide, if I hope we'll have time later, to show commodity price fluctuations during those years. But basically, what you see is, and some of you who have been on this committee longer remember these presentations over the many years where we had declining commodity prices, declining exploration spending, declining numbers of jobs. In fact, the only thing that really seemed to be increasing was operational costs during that time. And that reflected in the revenue that the state received. Commodity prices really made a difference on how much revenue came in, and there were higher operational costs. Of course, that started to turn around in 2016, and you see this jump in revenue because things have improved.
So I also think it's really important, during the first part of the hearing, you heard from the Department of Revenue focused really on the Alaska Alaska mining license tax. But it's important to remember the bigger picture because from a company's point of view, a tax is a tax. It doesn't matter whether you're paying one type of state tax or a federal tax. It all is a cost of doing business. And so they look at it on aggregate. So here in Alaska, if you've got a mine on state land, that mine is paying the federal corporate tax rate, of course, state corporate tax, the Alaska mining license tax, and a royalty. And of course, if they're in an organized borough, and of our six mines, five are in boroughs, then they're also paying a local property tax or a payment in lieu of taxes and local sales taxes on their local procurement. So we covered this slide in response to Representative Hannon's questions. But it's not just about revenue to state government. Mining pays its way. The companies pay their exploration costs and development costs, construction costs, and you know these are large, modern technology operations. For the large mines, you're looking at hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of dollars to bring a mine into production. One of the reasons why mining is so much more expensive in Alaska than in other places, and Representative Rasmussen in the previous presentation made a point of saying that you know Alaska's kind of unique because we have these higher costs, is the fact that we lack infrastructure. And so a mine isn't looking at just setting up the mine operation and the mill. They may also be looking at, well, where's their power source going to be? Are they going to be building a pipeline? Are they going to have to bring in a power transmission line, a power generation plant? Will they have to build a road, build a port? These are all costs that are borne by the industry. And you don't see that, for example, in a state so much. Well, you don't see it so much in a state like, say, Nevada. You know, if our incredible deposits were in a state like Nevada, where there's already access to road and rail and power transmission, it's just so much easier to develop that mine at a much much lower capital expense. And then, of course, Deantha already mentioned that. All of the mines are required to put up a bond for the for reclamation and closure so that they are responsible for those costs themselves. But if for some reason the state has to step in, the money is available for the state to do so. Normally this is part of the previous slide, but I wanted to pull it out because a lot of people are not aware of reimbursable service agreements. I mentioned it briefly in one of the previous slides, but that is the amount that the state bills back to the companies for their permitting and oversight costs. And so you see it fluctuates, and it's gone over 6 years between $1 and $2.6 million dollars. And that's because when a large mine starts permitting, there's a real increase in permitting costs. So you see those numbers, for example, when Donlin came in to started doing its permitting. We've got a couple of mines that are in just starting permitting or looking to in 2019, so you'll see that number go up again in a couple of years. I wanted to speak briefly about ADA as well, because when I mentioned that mining has to pay all of its infrastructure costs, of course there are a couple of exceptions, and one is the investment that ADA made into the Red Dog port and road. And one thing to remember about ADA is that it's got a dual mandate. It has to make wise investments. They have to be good at making money for the state of Alaska, but they also have to make investments that will increase economic growth in the state. And from both those measures, you could say that the Red Dog Port and Road has been an absolute success story for ADA. $265 million initially. They've already received more than $465 million with a contract that goes out to 2040. Hearing some of the previous hearings, there was talk about the Fraser Report, and I think it is valuable to look at the Fraser Report, but one of the reasons I put this slide in here is that ultimately that report is a survey. It's perception. Individual mining executives give their personal opinion, their experience, but I think it's equally or more important to actually look at where they spend their money. And in the 4 years from 2011 to 2016, you know, you saw this incredible decline in exploration spending, not just in Alaska. I mean, this is our Alaska number, but globally we saw it too. Commodity commodity prices tanked. There were a number of acquisitions that companies had to write down. There was it was almost impossible to raise money for mining exploration. Investors were very, very cautious. We saw that globally. We saw it very much here in Alaska. Over the last couple of years, that has started to turn around. Commodity prices have improved. There's just a little bit more ease in raising money on the stock exchanges. So we really see now that there's this upward trend. It's far from what it was, but we're going in the right direction at least. And so that shows, you know, some interest and determination to see Alaska as an attractive place to invest. We don't have the 2019 numbers yet, but anecdotally we think it'll be as good as 2018 or potentially even a little bit better. So how do we make sure that that number increases? And, you know, we know that as Diantha started the presentation, that our modern economies need to have mined minerals in our global economy. We've got world-class deposits, but we have to compete for global investment with all of the other mining jurisdictions in the world. And we need to, you know, we compete by having an attractive investment climate. We've got our specific challenges, the lack of infrastructure, the climate, the distance from markets. But the one thing that we can control is the perception of, is Alaska a good place to do business? And if we don't send that message, then the limited capital can go to other jurisdictions. So policies that can show fiscal certainty and regulatory certainty help investors make that decision. Ultimately, what it means when money is invested in Alaska is more jobs, more opportunities for Native corporations through revenue sharing, more local procurement, and more revenue for state and local governments. So many Alaska communities and thousands of Alaska miners and their families depend on a healthy mining industry. And I had hoped that I could have enough time to just show you very quickly. That's an electronic fund that for mining stocks in general, so it's not specific to one commodity, which is a much more difficult slide to do, and it only goes out to 2017, but because it invests in many, many mining stocks, it gives you a sense of how volatile the commodity prices are and what's happening in the industry. That huge dip on the far left is the financial crisis in 2008. And then you can also see that between that high in 2011 all the way to 2016, you just have this steady decline. So one of the reasons the Alaska Mineral License Tax was so low in 2016 was a result of 4 years of decline. I also just wanted to show you, the local hire, I think Representative Tara, you asked about that. So right now the Department of Labor's recent report says 62%, although it's based on full-time employees and based on PFD returns. It doesn't include contractors and some self-employed, including many of the 1,100 placer miners, did you say, Diantha? So our McDowell Group numbers tend to be a little higher. The important story, though, is to remember that in places where it's easy to get to work, like Fort Knox, you've got 100% of the employees are Alaskans living in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. NANA shareholders, 55% of more than 600 jobs, and their overall Alaska hire is 75%. The industry wants to hire Alaskans. They already know what it's like to live in Alaska. They're much more likely to stay. They make good employees. And what the industry has done to try to encourage that is support scholarships and training programs. So through the educational tax credit, over, an eight-year period, there was $20 million invested into vocational programs at high schools as well as the University of Alaska. In order to support programs that would train Alaskans to be the next generation of miners in Alaska.
I think that's. You get to take a breath.
Yeah, and 3 o'clock.
Thank you so much. I really apologize that we had run over, and so we had our full 2 hours, we would have had plenty of time. But in just the remaining minute or two, are there any questions from committee members? Representative Rauscher.
I don't have a question, but I did want to make a small statement. I noticed on a couple of the slides and on one of the handouts, there was a dot missing, and you spoke to it as far as the taxes locally that POGO may not be paying. But they do have some really nice contracts with the community of Delta Junction, and they do support that community very well, and they are a big supporter of that area, and I just thought I'd throw that in there because I represent their district.
All right. Always stand up for the home team. I had one question. We're not going to have time for it, but I know, Ms. Mathias, because you're Canadian, and I'm just wondering, you know, this issue of the power infrastructure, you know, energy infrastructure, I'm just wondering that if that is, you know, something that may not be unique to Alaska, and if you have any information from Canada, I'd just be curious in some of the other big geographic areas if they've found better solutions for that.
Actually, I have a very quick answer, and I don't have the slide with me with the specific name, but there was a comparison of a mine in northern Ontario that went into production just a few years ago, and it is roughly would be the same size as Donlin, about the same amount of throughput in terms of how much they would mill each day. And if I remember correctly, the capital investment was just over a billion Canadian dollars, and of course, Donlin is looking at $6-7 billion. In jurisdictions in mining jurisdictions in Canada, they have found ways to, even in the remote areas, to incentivize mining, whether it's through more public private partnerships in infrastructure and electrical transmission investment, or other ways, sometimes through tax incentives. But that's a huge difference for a similar size mine to be coming in at such a lower overall cost.
Yeah. Okay. Appreciate that. Any last comments or questions from committee members? Okay. Representative Tallarico.
I have a very embarrassing question because I've forgotten the number. I bet Ms. Crockett can tell me how much power we produce with coal.
Through the chair, Representative Tallarico, I did skim over that in my Yosebel-y point, but it is 39% of interior Alaska's electricity comes from Yosebel-y coal mine.
Thank you.
I think there was a question about a state comparison for required permits, and you were going to get back to us
on that
if you would.
That.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay, I promised that we'd have a bathroom break before the next committee for the two members that have to go from committee to committee who came straight from the floor, so we got to end. Excellent presentation by everyone today. Again, apologies that we had to cut it short. Stay tuned for whether we will have a meeting on Wednesday with the budget this week. It's possible that things could change, so we will keep in touch. With no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn at 3:05 p.m.